Some governors are still refusing to take action to protect their own citizens.
The media keep insisting government must set stricter rules.
10 states have no stay-at-home orders.
Even some on Fox say it.
It is necessary to shut things down everywhere. And that includes Utah, Wyoming.
Wait a second. Has he ever been to Wyoming? It's got so much open space. Why would the same rules apply here as in New York? It's creepy how some people are so eager to have authorities boss us around. Police departments now monitor people with drones.
This is the Volusia Sheriff's Office. Please adhere to social distancing guidelines.
Now some people are saying enough. These people are protesting North Carolina's stay-at-home order.
I feel that my rights have been completely removed.
On Twitter, the police declared protesting is a non-essential activity, and they arrested this woman. But wait a second, the Bill of Rights does say the American people have a right to peaceably assemble and petition the government.
All public and private gatherings of any size are prohibited.
Michigan's governor probably imposed the harshest rules.
Residents can no longer visit friends or relatives. Those who have more than one home banned from traveling between them.
No wonder people staged this protest against her rules.
They say it goes too far, takes away their rights, and in some cases is too arbitrary.
Arbitrary is how it looks. Big stores may stay open, but they must not sell certain things.
Big box stores will also have to close areas of the store that are dedicated to things like carpet or flooring, furniture, garden centers, plant nurseries, or paint.
But things like gardening and painting are activities that can be done far from other people. So is exercise. But watch out in California.
A paddleboarder is chased down by law enforcement for being out on the water at Malibu Beach.
This man was more than 6 feet from anyone, but police chased him down.
He cut him off!
And they punished him.
Yep, this paddleboarder was arrested.
In Encinitas, California, police gave $1,000 tickets to people watching the sunset. Yes, they were inside cars, not endangering anyone. That day, the police posted this video saying, "We go to work for you."
We're going to continue to be doing enforcement. We're dealing with the crisis at this point, and we want compliance from everybody because this is lives that we're trying to save.
But it's not clear that demanding total compliance is the best way to save lives.
In the Swedish city of Malmo, life appears to be carrying on almost as normal.
Sweden took a near opposite approach. Yes, they encourage older people to stay inside and tell sick people to stay home. They don't want hospitals overwhelmed. But otherwise, they let life happen.
In this street in Stockholm, there's not much evidence of social distancing.
Sweden's leaders don't think an extended shutdown is sustainable.
Closing schools, more stringent measures like that, closing borders, you cannot do that for months or years ahead. What we're doing in Sweden, we can continue to do for a long time, and I think that's going to prove to be very, very important in the long run.
Because a vaccine's probably more than a year away. Until then, the best protection is what epidemiologists call herd immunity. A critical mass of people who get the disease and then are resistant to it.
Herd immunity is the one thing that will eventually slow down the spread of this virus. Nothing else will slow it down in the long term.
The idea is that once enough people have gotten coronavirus, there'll be enough immunity to prevent future mass outbreaks and to protect the most vulnerable people. The jury's still out on Sweden's experiment. More than 1,000 Swedes have died, 5 times the deaths per capita as in neighboring Norway. But if Swedes acquire herd immunity, their death rate will be the first to drop. Other European countries have also concluded that lockdowns are not sustainable. Germany just freed retail stores from the lockdown. Denmark reopened classrooms. Norway's students will return in coming weeks. And Austria is reopening shops to people who wear masks on May 1st. That seems smarter than the absolute shutdown promoted by many American authorities.
If we see continued noncompliance, they'll wind up facing a misdemeanor charge, and DWP will step in and shut off their water and power.
Shut off their water? Let's be sensible about this. Politicians are supposed to serve us, not just boss us around. Hope you like these videos. We count on you to keep them going. If you'd like to help us make more, please press that button.
We'll be right back. To fight coronavirus and other diseases, we need new drugs. But the government's approval process for that takes so long.
Once it's approved for trials, researchers say the drug will be about 10 years away from hitting the market.
This year's pandemic got regulators to speed some approvals, but the process still takes a long time.
I think it's optimistically 12 to 18 months. Under normal circumstances, it takes 5 to 10 years to develop a vaccine.
It is a process designed to be slow.
I think about the FDA's rules more lately because my brother Tom, a medical researcher, discovered something that might save a lot of lives. Tom and I often fought as kids. Our mother drew this picture. We eventually stopped fighting and Tom helped raise me. I trusted him because he was so smart. He went to Princeton and Harvard and did such top-notch science that when our government feared Soviet microwaves were beamed at the U.S. Embassy, the State Department shipped Tom to Moscow to investigate. When Algeria's dictator got sick, they tapped Tom to treat him. And then, studying blood, Tom discovered an unusual protein. He named it gelsalin. Turns out gelsalin reduces excess inflammation. Now, some inflammation's useful. Our own immune system creates it to fight off diseases. But too much inflammation is a killer.
When COVID-19, what usually kills the patient is not the virus. In fact, as the patients get sicker, often the virus is disappearing anyway. It's the overexuberant, highly excessive immune reaction that's destroying the lung.
Dr. Mark DeNubley was once Tom's assistant and protege. Now he speaks for Tom because several months ago, Tom had a sudden heart attack and died. A few years before, he'd come on my television show and pointed out
the vast predominance of what gets products to patients comes from the private sector. Only the private sector has the resources and the skill sets to get the job done.
Now this company, BioAegis, is trying to get the FDA's permission to give Tom's protein to people with diseases like pneumonia, sepsis, and coronavirus. Because when you're very sick, gelsalin levels go down and inflammation gets worse.
We are not helpless here. That the gelsalin that's depleted can be replaced.
Will replacing gelsalin save lives by reducing inflammation? It did when BioAegis gave some to sick mice. The mice treated with some extra gelsalin got better.
More animals live, but it also improves what their lungs look like.
That improved lung function should help human coronavirus patients.
And protect the lung from injury and allow the patient to recover and get off the respirator and go back home and hopefully live a normal life.
BioAegis spent millions getting through the FDA's first layers of tests. After the animal tests succeeded, they spent millions more studying its safety in hospital patients. They gave them big doses of gelsalin, and the patients did fine. That was expected. Gelsalin's a natural protein, after all. It's already in our blood. Now BioAegis is trying to raise more millions to fund tests that would convince the FDA that gelsalin improves outcomes for sick people.
We were initially doing this before COVID-19. Now that COVID-19 is broken, and it's very possible, God willing, that we will get some approval from the Spanish agency in the next couple weeks.
Spain, because those fast approvals promised by our government, so far haven't helped gelsalin.
Go give it to them. I don't get why it takes years, why you have to beg for permission. Just find some sick people and who are willing to try something.
Well, we legally cannot do that until we get approval. The first rule of medicine is first do no harm.
Aren't a lot of diseases caused by too much inflammation? This could be a big deal.
The potential benefit is enormous. This could be a major step, you know, a miracle drug like antibiotics were.
I hope they succeed. I've invested in BioAegis. I'll probably lose that money because most new drugs never make it to market. We do want to make sure new drugs are safe. But in a pandemic, shouldn't there be a faster way to get promising treatments, ones that have already been proven safe, to people who might benefit? There ought to be. Hope you like our videos. If you have any interest or expertise in drug development, maybe you can help me with gelsalin. I'm in way over my head. Just email me at john@johnstossel.com.
Welcome to another MedCram COVID-19 update. It's been a few days since we did one, and I've been busy in the intensive care unit taking care of COVID-19 patients. And one of the things that has struck me in taking care of those patients is that while there is respiratory issues on the ventilator, it seems as though the biggest issue that we're dealing with is in the cardiovascular realm. It seems as though a lot of the patients that I'm taking care of are succumbing to cardiovascular complications such as myocardial infarction or blood clots, rather than the inability to ventilate. And we'll talk more about that later. I know there were a lot of questions last time about hydroxychloroquine and the review that we did on a number of the trials, and the questions were related to why zinc was not included in the trials. For those of you who are interested, in the intensive care unit that I work in, we use hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin and zinc supplementation. And I would add that in the intensive care unit, we are seeing the sickest of patients that are coming in. And so far, our outcomes are not very different than those that we presented from the JAMA article a few updates ago. But what I really want to get to is this disturbing article that was put in the Washington Post. Young and middle-aged people barely sick with COVID-19 are dying of strokes. Doctors sound alarm about patients in their 30s and 40s left debilitated or dead. Some didn't even know they were infected. And they talk about how this patient came into the hospital and had a stroke, and they were trying to remove the clot using the technology that they have. And it says here that he observed something that he had never seen before. On the monitors, the brain typically shows up as a tangle of black squiggles, like a can of spaghetti, he said, that provide a map of blood vessels. A clot shows up as a blank spot, and he used the needle device to pull the clot out. He saw new clots forming in real time around it. And the question is why is that happening? They mention in the article that many researchers suspect strokes in COVID-19 patients may be direct consequence of blood problems that are producing clots all over some people's bodies. They're mentioning here that they've taken care of patients in their 30s with stroke and COVID, and this was extremely surprising, he said. Many doctors expressed worry that as the New York City Fire Department was picking up four times as many people who died at home as normal during the peak of infection, that some of the dead had suffered sudden strokes. The truth may never be known because few autopsies were conducted. So finally, someone is trying to do some research. Dr. Chow is hoping to answer such questions through a review of strokes and other neurological complications in these COVID-19 patients. There was an interesting case study in thrombosis research that was accepted only a couple of weeks ago. And it goes through and talks about an interesting case, a case which is not unusual and one that I have seen many times in the intensive care unit with COVID-19. So this is a 72-year-old, otherwise healthy male, apparently. And 6 days after admission to the hospital, the patient started to decompensate and went into ARDS, acute renal insufficiency, and had altered level of consciousness, which required the patient to need to go to the intensive care unit. One of the things that they measured was something called a D-dimer. And on that first day, the D-dimer was 0.69, which is just barely elevated. But 4 days later, it was 2.55. 11 days into it, it went to 2.81. 21 days later, it was 20.63. And this is pretty high. And this is actually what I've been seeing in my COVID-19 patients as well. Then at day 24, came back down. We'll talk about what happened on day 21. Because when they started to see these numbers rising in a D-dimer, what that usually means is that there's some sort of coagulation occurring. So what you have to understand is that in the blood vessels are coated with tiny cells that are very flat called endothelium. And these tiny cells that are very flat have on their surface receptors and enzymes. And in this case, it's ACE2. And so the virus can actually attack this ACE2. We'll talk more about that later. But if there is inflammation that's occurring here in the endothelial cells, just below the endothelial surface is a collection of something called von Willebrand's factor. And von Willebrand's factor can be released when there's damage to the endothelium. And in the lumen of the blood vessel is factor 8, which is one of the active factors that converts factor 10 into the active form of factor 10A. It can get confusing talking about coagulation factors, but the key that I want you to understand is that von Willebrand's factor is subendothelial, and it can get into circulation, and it is a procoagulant. So when they went and measured here on day 21, what the measurement of von Willebrand's factor was, it was actually at 520% of what it normally should be. And when they measured factor 8, it was 369% of what it should be. So what they started at that point here was unfractionated heparin. This is an anticoagulant. This is something that inhibits the body's ability to coagulate. And when they did that, the D-dimer levels then dropped by day 24 to 6.26. And finally, by day 29, it dropped down to 1.94. The other thing that they noticed was here, they started noticing positive IgM antibodies for anti-cardiolipin antibody, and also positive for anti-beta 2 glycoprotein, even though the IgGs were negative, indicating an acute antibody. Now, it's interesting to note that they switched to unfractionated heparin. When the patient was first admitted, the patient was started on a prophylactic dose of dalteparin at around 5,000 units sub-Q daily. So it seems as though these blood clots may be mediated by very high levels of von Willebrand's factor and even factor 8 in the coagulation cascade. And why is this happening? It may be related to endothelial activation from inflammation that's going on and release of this von Willebrand's factor, which binds factor 8 in the lumen of the blood vessel. So why is all of this happening? It may be happening because the virus is taking out ACE2. Number one, because it's binding to ACE2. But number two, it may be taking it out because as it binds to ACE2, it's now rendering that enzyme completely inactive. Now, remember what we talked about back in update 37, where we talked about what happens with ACE2 in relation to angiotensinogen and angiotensin 1 and angiotensin 2. Let's review that real quickly. So in an infection with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, where you do not have the ACE2 enzyme, you're going to have NADPH oxidase raining unrestrained because there is no angiotensin 1-7. With that inflammation, you may have release of von Willebrand's factor, which will couple with factor 8 and form intra-arterial thromboses. And they state here that ACE2-based treatment approaches may be a novel approach to limit aberrant vascular responses and atherothrombosis. So let's summarize what's going on. Here we have SARS-CoV-2. And what happens is when you breathe it in, it's going to go first to your lungs. And specifically, it's going to go to the ACE2 receptor in your lungs. And what we all thought and imagined was that we were going to get ARDS. And that's why we started treating patients with hypoxia secondary to ARDS, because this is what we all were expecting for months and months. But the virus gets worse and spreads, and then it starts to go into the blood vessels. And the blood vessels inside of them also have ACE2. And what happens is when it goes to ACE2, now we have unopposed angiotensin 2, We have release of von Willebrand's factor and factor VIII, and so we get thrombosis. And with this happening, these things happen so quickly that before this ARDS has a chance to get bad enough to cause the H type of lung problem, we have thrombosis, which is causing the ground glass opacification, and we get the L type of lung problem. And the final common denominator in this process over here, which seems to be taking most of the patients in the intensive care unit, is a process known as oxidative stress. And as we'll show in the upcoming lectures and updates, the people with the worst oxidative stress from a baseline standpoint are those people with cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, and overweight. And these are exactly the same people who we see as having the largest risk of dying in COVID-19. What we have over here are the happy hypoxics. These are the patients that look like they're at high altitude, according to some emergency room physicians. These are the people who are having cardiovascular collapse and blood clots in their vessels. These are the ones that are put on ventilators, but to little avail. And so I think that an understanding of oxidative stress and how it might be involved with COVID-19 is going to be instructive, and it may give us some avenues for therapeutics. So if you like this video, click like. If you want to see more videos like this, make sure you click the subscribe button. And if you want to be notified when I get those videos done, then make sure you hit the bell button. And for more educational videos on demand, visit us at medcram.com. Thank you for joining us.
The goal of the fly fisherman is to catch trout through skillful deception. The test is the pitting of the fisherman's knowledge and skill against the noble trout. He will often craft by hand the lures he uses. He knows these artificial insects, embedded with tiny hooks, need to be perfect deception, because the trout will identify even the slightest flaw and reject the fly. Like the fly fisherman who knows that the trout are driven by hunger, Lucifer also knows our hunger or our weaknesses. Satan knows how to exploit and ensnare us with artificial substances and behaviors of temporary pleasure. He uses addiction to steal away agency. And when that happens, the hook is set and Lucifer takes control. For those of you who have fallen prey to any kind of addiction, there is hope, because God loves all of his children and because the atonement of the Lord Jesus Christ makes all things possible. It begins with prayer, sincere, fervent, and constant communication with the Creator of our spirits and bodies, our Heavenly Father. Set aside all pride and turn your life and your heart to Him. Ask to be filled with the power of Christ's pure love. For as the Apostle Paul claimed, I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. I testify to you, your body, mind, and spirit can be transformed, cleansed, and made whole. and you will be freed.
Thank you.